welcome to a continuing series of messages surveying books of the Bible. Our speaker is Dr. Ken Boa, president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today's study is on the book of Hosea. Here now is our teacher, Dr. Ken Boa.
Welcome to the Talk Through the Bible Visual Bible Overview Series. Today we're going to survey the book of Hosea to give you a better feel for the contents of the book as you begin to study it. Looking at the Old Testament, from a chronological standpoint, there are three major types of books: historical, poetical, and prophetical. But chronologically, Hosea supplements the 11 Old Testament books that move the storyline of the Old Testament forward in time. From this skeleton of the historical books, the poetical and the prophetical books hang. For our purposes today, we will be looking at the book of Hosea, which occurs during the time of the kings around the exile of Israel's 10 northern tribes to Assyria. Let's begin with an introduction to Hosea and to its title. Hosea, whose name means salvation, ministers to the northern kingdom of Israel, also called Ephraim after its largest tribe. Outwardly, the nation is enjoying a time of prosperity and growth, but inwardly, moral corruption and spiritual adultery permeate the people. Hosea, instructed by God to marry a woman named Gomer, finds his domestic life to be an accurate and tragic dramatization of the unfaithfulness of God's people. During his half-century of prophetic ministry, Hosea repeatedly echoes his threefold message: God abhors the sins of his people, judgment is certain, but God's loyal love stands firm. The names Hosea, Joshua, and Jesus are all derived from the same Hebrew root word. The word Hosea means salvation, but Joshua and Jesus include an additional idea: Yahweh is salvation. As God's messenger, Hosea offers the possibility of salvation if only the nation will turn from idolatry back to God. Israel's last king, Hosea, has the same name as the prophet, even though the English Bible spells them differently. Hosea in the Greek and Latin is Osei. Let's have a look at the authorship of the book of Hosea. Few critics refute the claim in chapter 1, verse 1, that Hosea was the author of this book. His place of birth is not given, but his familiarity and obvious concern with the northern kingdom indicate that he lived in Israel, not Judah. This is also seen when he called the king of Samaria our king in 7:5. Hosea was the son of Beeri, 1:1, husband of Gomer, 1:3, and father of two sons and a daughter, 1:4, 6, and 9. Nothing more is known of him since he is not mentioned elsewhere in the Bible. Hosea had a real compassion for his people, and his personal suffering because of Gomer gave him some understanding of God's grief over their sin. Thus his words of coming judgment were passionately delivered, but tempered with a heart of tenderness. He upbraided his people for their lying, murder, insincerity, ingratitude, idolatry, and covetousness with cutting metaphors and images, but his messages were punctuated with consolation and future hope. Turning our attention to Hosea's date and setting, Hosea addressed the northern kingdom of Israel, 5:1, often called Ephraim after the largest tribe, 5:3, 5, 11, 13. According to chapter 1, verse 1, he ministered during the reigns of Uzziah, 767 to 739 BC, Jotham, 739 to 731 BC, Ahaz, 731 to 715 BC, and Hezekiah, 715 to 686 BC, kings of Judah. When Hosea began his ministry, Jeroboam II, 782 to 753 BC, was still reigning in Israel. This makes Hosea a younger contemporary of Amos, another prophet to the northern kingdom. Hosea was also a contemporary of Isaiah and Micah, who ministered to the southern kingdom. Hosea's long career continued after the time of Jeroboam II and spanned the reigns of the last six kings of Israel, from Zechariah, 753 to 752 BC, to Hosea, 732 to 722 BC. Hosea evidently compiled this book in the early years of Hezekiah, and his ministry stretched from about 755 BC to about 710 BC. The book of Hosea represents approximately 40 years of prophetic ministry. When Hosea began his ministry, Israel was enjoying a temporary period of political and economic prosperity under Jeroboam II. However, the nation began to crumble after Tiglath-Pileser III, 745 to 727 BC, strengthened Assyria. The reigns of Israel's last six kings were relatively brief, since four were murdered and a fifth was carried captive to Assyria. Confusion and decline characterized the last years of the northern kingdom, and her people refused to heed Hosea's warning of imminent judgment. The people were in a spiritual stupor, riddled with sin and idolatry. Now that we've covered some background, let's move deeper into the book of Hosea itself. Hosea is called by God to prophesy during Israel's last hours, just as Jeremiah will prophesy years later to the crumbling kingdom of Judah. As one commentator has noted, what we see in the prophecy of Hosea are the last few swirls as the kingdom of Israel goes down the drain. This book represents God's last gracious effort to plug the drain. Hosea's personal tragedy is an intense illustration of Israel's national tragedy. It is the story of one-sided love and faithfulness that represents the relationship between Israel and God. Just as Gomer is married to Hosea, Israel is betrothed to God. Both relationships gradually disintegrate. Homer runs after other men, and Israel runs after other gods. Israel's spiritual adultery is illustrated in Gomer's physical adultery. The development of the book can be traced in two parts: the adulterous wife and faithful husband, chapters 1 to 3, and the adulterous Israel and faithful Lord, chapters 4 to 14. The adulterous wife and faithful husband, chapters 1 to 3. Hosea marries a woman named Gomer, who bears him three children, appropriately named by God as signs to Israel: Jezreel, Lo Ruhama, and Lo Ami, mean God scatters, not pitied, and not my people. Similarly, God will judge and scatter Israel because of her sin. Gomer seeks other lovers and deserts Hosea. In spite of the depth to which her sin carries her, Hosea redeems her from the slave market and restores her. The adulterous Israel and faithful Lord, chapters 4 to 14. Because of his own painful experience, Hosea can feel some of the sorrow of God over the sinfulness of his people. His loyal love for Gomer is a reflection of God's concern for Israel. However, Israel has fallen into the dregs of sin and is hardened against God's gracious last appeal to return. The people have flagrantly violated all of God's commandments, and they are now indicted by the holy God for their crimes. Even now, God wants to heal and redeem them, 7:1-13, but in their arrogance and idolatry, they rebel. Chapters 9 to 10 give the verdict of the case God has just presented. Israel's disobedience will lead to her dispersion. For they sow the wind, 4-7, and they reap the whirlwind, 8-10. Israel spurns repentance, and the judgment of God can no longer be delayed. God is holy, 4-7, and just, 8-10, but he is also loving and gracious, 11-14. God must discipline, but because of his endless love, he will ultimately save and restore his wayward people. How can I give you up, Ephraim? I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from him. 11:8, 14:4. The topics of Hosea move from the marriage of Hosea to the message of Hosea, and from Hosea's personal tragedy to Israel's national tragedy. The place of the book is the northern kingdom of Israel, around 755 to 710 BC. Let's look next at the theme and purpose of Hosea. The themes of chapters 1 to 3 echo throughout the rest of the book. The adultery of Homer, chapter 1, illustrates the sin of Israel, chapters 4 to 7. The degradation of Homer, chapter 2, represents the judgment of Israel, chapters 8 to 10. And Hosea's redemption of Gomer, chapter 3, pictures the restoration of Israel, chapters 11 to 14. More than any other Old Testament prophet, Hosea's personal experiences illustrated his prophetic message. In his relationship to Gomer, Hosea portrayed God's faithfulness, justice, love, and forgiveness toward his people. The theme of God's holiness is developed in contrast to Israel's corruption and apostasy. Hosea utters about 150 statements concerning the sins of Israel, and more than half deal specifically with idolatry. The theme of God's justice is contrasted with Israel's lack of justice. There was never a good king in Israel, and judgment is long overdue. The theme of God's love is seen in contrast to Israel's hardness and empty ritual. God's loyal love is unconditional and ceaseless. In spite of Israel's manifold sins, God tries every means to bring his people back to himself. He pleads with the people to return to him, but they will not. O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. 14:1. Now we'll turn our attention to a few keys to understanding Hosea. As we have seen from God's constant pursuit of unfaithful Israel, the key word for Hosea is God's loyal love for Israel. One of the two key verses in Hosea reflecting this key word is found in chapter 4. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. 4:1. The second key verse demonstrates God's loyal love in spite of Israel's unfaithfulness. My people are bent on backsliding from me. Though they call to the Most High, none at all exalt him. How can I give you up, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I make you like Adma? How can I set you like Zeboiim? My heart churns within me, my sympathy is stirred. I will not execute the fierceness of my anger. I will not again destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in your midst, and I will not come with terror. 11:7-9. The key chapter is 4. The nation of Israel has left the knowledge of the truth and followed the idolatrous ways of their pagan neighbors. Central to the book is verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being priest for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. As we consider some of the contributions of Hosea to the Bible, Hosea is the first of the 12 minor prophets, perhaps because of its size. The New Testament quotes or alludes to its vivid contents several times. Chapter 1, verse 10 in Romans and 2 Corinthians, chapter 2, verse 23 in Romans and 1 Peter, chapter 6, verse 6 in Matthew, chapter 10, verse 8 in Luke and Revelation, chapter 11, 1 in Matthew, chapter 13, 14 in 1 Corinthians, and chapter 14, 2 in Hebrews. There are different views concerning Hosea's marriage to Gomer. Some see it as a fictional allegory of God and Israel, but there is little basis for this position. Chapters 1 to 3 are presented as a straightforward narrative, and there are no indications that it is fictitious. Although Hosea was told to take a wife of harlotry in 1:2, this does not necessarily mean that Gomer was a harlot before her marriage to Hosea. This passage may be looking ahead to what she would become. Now let's look at ways in which Christ is portrayed in Hosea. Matthew 2:15, which reads, "That what was spoken by the Lord through the prophet might be fulfilled, saying, 'Out of Egypt did I call my son,' applies chapter 11, verse 1, to Christ in Egypt. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son." Matthew quotes the second half of this verse to show that the exodus of Israel from Egypt as a new nation was a prophetic type of Israel's Messiah, who was also called out of Egypt in his childhood. Both Israel and Christ departed to take refuge in Egypt. Christ's identification with our plight and his loving work of redemption can be seen in Hosea's redemption of Gomer from the slave market. And finally, in our overview of the book of Hosea, we'll consider three applications. The first application, when God's goodness is pushed too far. Because of God's enduring patience and the apparent lack of negative consequences related to our sin, we, like Israel, often think that God somehow accepts or overlooks our behavior. But if there is anything that we should learn from both Israel and Judah, it is that God has his divine limits on the amount of sin that he tolerates. When we presume upon him or repeatedly ignore him, instead choosing our own way, there is a real line that we can cross with him. Consider the nearly 40 direct warnings God gave Israel through Hosea, using the phrase, "I will." "I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel. I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel. I will also make her like a wilderness and slay her with thirst. I will have no compassion on her children. I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. I will also put an end to all her gaiety. I will destroy her vines and fig trees. I will punish her for the days of the Baals. I will destroy your mother. I will change their glory into shame. I will punish them for their ways. I will chastise all of them. I will pour out my wrath like water. I will be like a lion to Ephraim. I, even I, will tear to pieces and go away. I will go away and return to my place until they acknowledge their guilt. I will spread my net over them. I will bring them down like the birds of the sky. I will chastise them in accordance with the proclamation to their assembly. I will send a fire on its cities, that it may consume its palatial dwellings. I will bereave them until not a man is left. I will drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. I will slay the precious ones of their womb. I will encounter them like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open their chests. I will also devour them like a lioness, as a wild beast would tear them. The sad truth is that through the ruthless Assyrian army in 722 BC, God did everything he told Israel he would do. When he warned, "I will," he meant what he said. In his classic book entitled The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis observed that there are only two kinds of people in the end: those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, in the end, "Thy will be done." God allows us to complete freedom, to exercise our will, but doing so while ignoring his will creates severe consequences for us, in which his holiness and justice may require him to declare, "I will." The key application for us today is to recognize that love has its limits, even God's perfect, unconditional love. Israel discovered the difficult way that God's goodness can only be pushed so far before he declares enough. Any Israelite who presumed upon God's grace to save them from the judgment of which the prophet Hosea and others warned were surely shocked when God diminished the 10 northern tribes through the Assyrians. We are unwise if we think that God's nature has changed even slightly towards sin. While God's amazing patience lasted for centuries with Israel, in the end he punished them severely. May we learn from Israel's example to avoid a similar tragic assumption and fate. The second application concerns God's amazing tenderness. Having just explored the limits of God's love as well as his fearsome wrath, Hosea, like Isaiah, also expresses God's incredible tenderness. In spite of all the "I wills" of judgment, in spite of the fact that God was exasperated with Israel's sin to the point of hating them for their evil, as he says in 9:15, in spite of Israel's worthless oaths and unfaithfulness to their covenant with him, God still pursued his Gomer-like bride to win her wicked heart. "I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her. I will give her her vineyards from there. I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice, in loving kindness and in compassion. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness. I will sow her for myself in the land. I will also have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. I will say to those who were not my people, 'You are my people,' and they will say, 'Thou art my God.' I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from them. I will be like the dew to Israel. He will blossom like the lily, and he will take root like the cedars of Lebanon." In addition to God's unmerited wooing, we see his gentleness and his constant care for his beloved bride, reminding her that it was always he who quietly supported her. "Yet I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, and you were not to know any God except me, for there is no Savior besides me. I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought." 13:4-5. But perhaps the best example of God's fatherly tenderness is displayed in chapter 10, where he portrays Israel as his own young child, just learning how to walk, and later as being wounded and then enslaved and hungry. "Yet it is I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them in my arms. But they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of a man, with bonds of love. And I became to them as one who lifts the yoke from their jaws, and I bent down and fed them. 10:3-4. We see God's gentle leadership style, one that leads not as a tyrant, but with the bonds of love, and one who seeks to lift the yoke of slavery from his beloved. And we see that he is a God who, as C.S. Lewis phrased it in his book entitled The Problem of Pain, stoops to conquer with his love. Lewis adds, he will have us even though we have shown that we prefer everything else to him, and come to him because there is nothing better now to be had. C.S. Lewis, The Problem of Pain. God's gracious loving kindness to us, who are often faithless covenant breakers like Gomer, is remarkable. This is the God portrayed in the book of Hosea, a God who is absolutely worthy of our devotion and lifelong worship. Though his patience has limits, there is no sin that he cannot redeem, and no repentant heart that he will spurn. His love and tenderness is not fickle, temporary, or conditional. As long as we invite him into our lives to have his way, we can count on the Savior's tenderness in our own lives. The third application raises the question, do we really want what we think we want? One of the unusual aspects to being human is that desire can help us survive and avoid pain, but it can also have the exact opposite effect. For example, we can desire things such as food, necessary for survival, yet if we eat too much, our unchecked desire for food can create a variety of associated health problems, such as diabetes, heart disease, and many others. The trap of thinking that something we desire is good for us, but later finding out otherwise, is exactly the one in which Israel found themselves caught. They wanted a king, and thought that change would be good for them, as Israel requested of the prophet Samuel. Now appoint a king for us, to judge us like all the nations. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. 1 Samuel 8:5-7. Thus Israel wanted to be like all the other nations around them with a human king instead of God being their king. They wholeheartedly thought that this rulership change would be beneficial to them. God did not see it that way, and thus commanded Samuel to warn them about the consequences of this choice. Like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. 1 Samuel 8:8-9. Samuel then warns the Israelites of the list of negative consequences of installing a human king to rule over them, including taking away their sons and daughters in service to himself, taking some of them away to be the king's military officers, farmers, blacksmiths, and craftsmen, taking away the very best of their fields and vineyards and olive groves for himself, taking away 1/10 of all their wealth for his purposes, and taking away their best servants, flocks, and beasts of burden for his use. The Lord adds to this warning, then you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. 1 Samuel 8:18. And how did Israel respond to this solemn warning from the omniscient, loving God? Nevertheless, the people refused to listen to the voice of Samuel, and they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. 1 Samuel 8:19-20. Israel wanted to be like the other nations and have a king, but God warned them that this would be terribly costly and indeed not in their best interest. and they would come to realize this truth and then cry out to God about the matter. But God promised them that he would not listen to this cry. Thus Israel wanted what was bad for them, yet God accommodated their passionate request. Over the ensuing years, God gave Israel three kings. And then Israel and Judah split into two divided kingdoms. Of the kingdom of Israel's 19 kings, not a single one was righteous in God's sight. And all but one of its 9 dynasties were created by murdering the previous king. Israel never broke away from Jeroboam's idolatrous calf worship, and the king's rule was oppressive to the people of Israel, just as God had warned them. And finally, the last king could not save the northern kingdom of Israel from doom and captivity by the ruthless Assyrian army. And as the invading Assyrian army approaches Israel, God, through the prophet Hosea, asked, "Where now is your king that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges, of whom you requested, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger, and took him away in my wrath." 13:10-11. Through Hosea, God reveals that he accommodated Israel's request, but in anger, and it was in his wrath that he took away the monarchical system about which God forewarned Israel. God wanted to be their king, and Israel rejected him. The application here is to be careful what we repeatedly, passionately ask God for what we think is in our best interest. As Israel demonstrated with their intense desire for a king, we are capable of wanting that which is actually not best for us. It is wiser to be open-handed about what we want, asking for God's best will for our lives, rather than trying to force God to follow our will. He always has our best interest at heart, so let us trust him with the answers to prayers that we like as well as those which we dislike. In his omniscience and unfathomable wisdom and goodness, he will always do what is ultimately in our best interest.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.